Hello, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you thought you heard him a few minutes ago, you did, but his voice was going, and so we gave him the morning off. We're pleased to welcome Professor Emeritus John Merrill, housing specialist in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. John, nice enough for you to walk into work today.
It's very nice. A lot of snow, but we were surprised when we came back from Georgia and found all the snow. We'd heard about it, but it's still, we haven't seen this much snow in years.
That is true.
It was a pleasant first experience, and now I'm ready for it to go.
Okay. Well, we'll be able to find out more about that when we get closer to the news. But right now, we're going to talk about home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues with John. And you're welcome to join us. Looks like the phone lines are full, but let me give you the number. In Madison, it's 263-1890. Otherwise, toll-free at 800-642-1234. And John, as Larry mentioned earlier, according to City of Milwaukee records, only 1,039 single house renovation permits were issued there last year. That doesn't seem like an awful lot for a city the size of Milwaukee.
Now, given the scale of the remodeling industry and the amount spent on remodeling materials, that does not seem very high. I agree.
When is a permit required for work in a typical city urban environment in Wisconsin?
You should. I'm not sure of the actual specific requirements from place to place, but if you're having any work done by a professional, it's a good idea for you to have it done. If you're having it because you're not sure when somebody comes in whether they're doing an adequate job or not, whether the electrical's up to code, the plumbing's up to code. And if you have a permit, you'll have to have permits for each of those aspects of it, and inspectors will make sure the plans are good to begin with, and they'll follow through with making sure the installation is appropriate. So it's a protection for the homeowner.
Mm-hmm.
And the homeowner should not pull the permit if he's hiring a contractor. He should get the contractor to do it, but he should make sure there is a permit.
What if he's doing the work himself?
Then it's a matter of what the scale of the work is. I mean, if you're doing painting, replacing some doors or windows, something that doesn't have any structural significance, doing a little insulating, probably that's not an issue. But if you're going to get into more serious stuff, it's a good idea to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to sell the house and someone comes in and sees all this work that's been done and wants to know who did it, you say, oh, I did it, and then they're going to say, is that adequately done or not? If you have the building permits to show that you pulled those and that was inspected properly, it gives the buyer an added sense of confidence.
Okay. John Merrill is our guest. The phone lines are full, so let's go to them and find out what's on Aaron's mind in Grafton. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I are remodeling our home, doing extensive remodeling. We just put on a second floor, but we want to put an addition to it also, and I'm wondering, you know, there's freeze walls and there's floating slabs, and I'm wondering when you are attaching, you know, an addition to a house, what's the best way to go, to where it's obviously going to be attached to it, so is the freeze wall the best way to go, or
well, you
don't want it where it pulls away from the house,
A floating slab might tend to do that. I mean, it's better to provide a frost wall, which means a wall that goes down to the frost line, and it'll provide the same kind of stability that the house has in general. Because you do want, the worst thing that can happen is that the house is, you attach the addition to the house structurally, and then the outside of the foundation drops a few inches, and there's gaps in the roof and all kinds of problems. So having a good solid frost wall all around with installed properly, compacted soil and all that is a good plan, I think.
So even though the other ones, obviously, it was built in the 50s, it's settled and all that kind of stuff, and you're attaching that freeze wall to the up against the other freeze wall, you know, still will move at the same?
That's what you want. You want it to move at the same rate.
By doing that, what you're suggesting is the way to do it, Beth.
That's what I'm suggesting.
And good luck to you, Aaron. Appreciate hearing from you. And our next caller would be Jim in Madison. And Jim, what's on your mind today?
My home is 44 years old with traditional cedar siding. It's becoming increasingly difficult to keep paint on it. What are the negatives to vinyl siding, if any? And if I have it done, what are the do's and don'ts of having it done?
Well, vinyl siding has improved over the years. It used to be that it was very brittle when it was cold. In the heat, it would swell and buckle somewhat. But now it's the composition has improved, so it's much less sensitive to sunlight. There's a wider array of colors. It's stronger. It's used in, I believe it's a majority of houses now. Mm-hmm. It's the most common siding that's available. And if you're going to, there are, one of the places you might want to go to look at vinyl siding is the Vinyl Siding Institute's website. I don't have that, but it's a very, very simple search, Vinyl Siding Institute, and they have lots of literature as a trade association, not as a specific manufacturer, that'll help you look at the different kinds of vinyl siding that are available and make a decision that way.
Larry Mueller is replacing his siding because of hail damage that occurred last year, and was shown some new up-to-date vinyl siding that looked like wood and had the appearance of wood. It was hard to tell the difference.
No, it's a good quality siding these days. There's a sort of prejudice. It's plastic siding.
Right.
On the other hand, the purpose of siding is to keep water, to help water shed from the outside of the house, and it does that very well.
Good luck to you, Jim. Thank you very much for your call. Let's see what's on Susan's mind in Middleton. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I have a house with two heaters and two modern thermostats, and the problem is when we have guests who are in the basement level and we set the thermostat for some comfort for them, especially when we had this really cold weather, and we're running it upstairs, you know, we have it set fairly low. But if they're both running at the same time, the downstairs control will start to get in this mode where it cycles like 30 seconds on, 30 off, 30 on, 30 off. And I had a person come out and look at the furnace, and he said the furnace is working fine. It's getting a signal from the thermostat to come on, and he couldn't really understand why that was happening. I'm wondering, is there anything I can do to make the two talk to each other correctly?
You had a furnace technician come out, and he looked at the furnace, but he didn't look at the, he couldn't work on the thermostat?
Well, he looked at the thermostat, and he said it looked like it was working okay, but he didn't know why it was cycling. He said the heater itself was getting the right signal. It would say, okay, I need to come on again, and so it would come on after 30 seconds.
Well, I mean, I don't have a magic answer for that. That's,
okay.
One of the things that comes to mind is that if the thermostat is pretty new and you happen to have the instructions that came with it, mm-hmm. one of the things that thermostats have is a setting to establish how much drop in temperature there has to be before it kicks on.
Okay, I didn't see that in the instructions.
And it could be that gap is not set large enough. And if you look at the instructions carefully, that ought to be a setting that's typically you don't even think about because it's there.
Right.
But it could be that somehow that is faulty. And if that isn't the case, and you've had a technician that you trust who says the furnace is working fine, new thermostats aren't all that expensive.
Okay. It's one of those things where ours is kind of complicated because it has more wires than it's supposed to when you take the thermostat off the wall. Because I called the thermostat company as well. And they said it's, you know, I don't know, we have 9 wires and you're supposed to have 5 or something.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of wiring.
Right.
And a lot of connections.
Is it supposed to connect both furnaces somehow?
No, not that I know of, but, you know, the house was built in 84, so I don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm suspicious of that thermostat.
Okay.
It just...
Yeah. I mean, I would either do it yourself or... If it's got a lot of wiring, you're not sure which wires to connect to the new one, have somebody else come in and who can do with
it. Well, we put it in, and we at the time had to talk to the thermostat company to get the explanation on which wires to connect to it.
Well,
maybe I should just go with the professional.
I think maybe.
Okay.
Good luck, Susan.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Our guest is John Merrill. He is a housing specialist in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, professor emeritus. And the number for you, if you'd like to get your question in and answered today, in Madison, it's 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go next to Dennis in Janesville and see what we can do for him. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My wife and I have built a brand-new house, and we have a foundation that runs under the entire house, including under the garage. So the garage floor then would be pre-stressed concrete. And I want to utilize the space underneath the garage floor. So I'm kind of wondering if I can, because I'm kind of worried about moisture coming through the concrete from in the wintertime from cars sitting on it. So am I better off to not insulate that concrete on the ceiling of the underspace, or can I just Should I just paint it, or should I not do anything?
Well, you can certainly put, for one thing, you should probably seal the concrete at the top, which you may have been planning to do anyway.
Yeah, and they've told me that, too, that I should be sealing that.
Right.
And then once, if you've done that and you maintain that, and you may need to put that on fairly regularly, as opposed to thinking you've done it once and can't forget it, then you can put some kind of insulation on the ceiling that's not affected by water. But you want to, if you want to use that space for anything that's going to be above freezing, you really have to have some insulation. There are you can have sprayed on foam put in. You can install rigid foam yourself against there.
And then I'd have to put some drywall or something on top.
If you're going to use it for living space and you have. Most foams, there are some foams now that have a that do not require a sheetrock cover or a fire retardant cover. The foil face foams, I believe, do not. But you need to check on that.
Okay.
I haven't checked that out recently.
But as long as I keep the concrete sealed above, you know, on the garage floor, then I shouldn't have any problems at all then.
You shouldn't have any problems. You've got a fairly watertight seal. I mean, concrete's fairly watertight, and if you keep it sealed and there aren't cracks developing that are left unfixed, it should be good.
I've run into some different opinions from the builder and everybody else. So.
Now, the other thing, there's two kinds of moisture problems. One is the water, liquid water, bulk water coming through the concrete, and the other is, and that could be through capillary flow, which is what the sealer will take care of. Or it could be condensation, which forms on the cold surface. And the condensation, if you have that foam tightly affixed to the concrete, then the plane of condensation should be on the warm side of the foam as opposed to between the foam and the concrete.
Okay, and then second thing, would I need to put a vapor barrier on that too then, or is that, you guys discussed putting vapor barriers in there.
Vapor barrier should go on the warm side of any surface, any interior surface.
Some kind of thing about using a vapor barrier basement because of the moisture issue coming from the outside in.
Well, I'm assuming you've taken care of the vapor barrier has to do with moisture inside the house, moist air, and moist. Well, the vapor barrier specifically is to prevent the diffusion of moisture through the interior wall into the wall cavity. And in fact, most moisture gets into wall cavities by the movement of air into the cavities. And then it takes the moisture in the air there, and then the air cools and moisture condenses on whatever surface it finds coldest.
Good luck to you, Dennis. We appreciate hearing from you and hope that you're able to solve that problem. Our next caller is going to be Barbara, and we'll get to her call in just a moment. John Merrill is our guest, and as we talk about home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about home renovation with John Merrill. He's a professor emeritus in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. And Barbara in Madison is our next caller. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. I live in a home that's about 1,800 square feet. It's about 25 years old. We have the original furnace, and we have been investigating replacing that furnace. The problem is that we have a second story, and the upstairs bedrooms are always cold in the winter, and also too warm in the summertime, even though we have central air and central heat. And one of the contractors who came over suggested that we move our furnace from the far corner of the unfinished part of the basement more to the central, more towards the middle of the basement in the part that's unfinished. And then another person came by who's doing some work down there and suggested that we get a new furnace but keep it where it is, that that's the best place for the furnace, at the far end against the wall. So we don't know what to do about that, but we do want to solve the problem of not getting enough heat to the second story.
And this is a warm air furnace with forced air.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's something the contract, you've told the contractors, and I'm sure they're dealing with it. Part of it may be that they're too long, the duct runs are too long. The other part may be that you don't have proper insulation in the house. And if you, that one of the concerns would be that you have not enough insulation in your attic so that the heat leaves more quickly than it should. And in the sidewalls, that would affect both the summer and the winter. A furnace technician should be able to check the airflow that you're getting to see how much heat is actually coming out of the registers in your second floor. Or
we have been told that there's not enough airflow, that that
okay.
is a problem. But one person said that it's just a problem with houses like this, that sometimes, you know, it has to travel a distance, so you're not going to have a lot of heat on the second floor.
Oh, there are ways to take care of that. It may be the duct size, it may be the blower size, but there are ways that you can at least improve it. So I would keep hunting until I found a furnace technician that could would be willing to respond to that. It's not just the furnace; it's the duct worked as well, and you have to make sure that they're working together properly to get that move that heat up there. And if the furnace is on one end of the house and that increases the length of the duct work, that could contribute to your problem. Whereas if it was in the center and all the duct runs tended to be shorter because of that, that might improve the situation.
Now, are there any guidelines about how close to a living area your furnace can be? Because we part of the basement is refinished and is used, and we're putting in an egress window so that we can have a bedroom down there. So is that a problem?
It's not a problem. Mobile homes have furnaces and closets sitting right in the middle of the space. Oh. And I presume your new furnace is going to be a sealed combustion unit that will take air from outside and bring air from the outside, so
mm-hmm.
it won't be impacting the air in the house.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck. Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Jane is next in Madison. And, Jane, what can we do for you?
Yeah, I have a question about my roof. The house is about 70 years old, and the shingles, I've been told, are probably an asbestos composite with cement or whatever else they used. And I'm wondering a couple things about it. Is there a place I should have that tested, a shingle tested for the asbestos?
Sure. You can have it tested. The state, if you call the Madison Health Department, they'll give you the number of the state occupational health lab, and they will test it for you for about $30 a sample, something in that order. I haven't had occasion to call them recently to see what the current price is, but it's a relatively small amount. And they're located here in Madison. They don't take much of any. They just take a small amount of the shingle or the sampling material.
Yeah. Well, I've got some another question about the shingles then. Somebody told me to do everything I can not to have to replace them because of the cost. And I'm wondering about moss that's growing in certain areas with dirt. You know, it's got that buildup underneath the shingles
mm-hmm.
in places. And is that detrimental to the shingles and the roofing? Or
In general, having moss grow on a roof is detrimental because it allows moisture to stay there and can cause decomposition over time.
Okay.
So it's appropriate to get it off. One of the things that you can install, which I, this is one of the few things where people have called back on the show and said, this really works, okay. There are some zinc strips that you can have laid across your roof just below the ridge on both sides. These zinc strips are sacrificial in that they, when the sun hits them, cause them to oxidize, then the rain hits them and the oxidized zinc goes down the roof and will, it's a fungicide essentially, and it kills the moss.
I have a very, very steep roof. I don't know how to, you put it at the top?
Near the top, just one row. It's about an inch and a half wide. And you put one row on each side near the ridge so that the sun hits it and that the water flows down over it.
Okay, and what about a shaded area, though? Does it need the sun?
It doesn't need the sun.
Okay.
Just the air and the warmth and all that.
All right, and then if I have a piece of this broken off, I have a spot on the edge of the roof that was broken off with a big branch that came down. So to repair that one spot, it's right on the edge. What would be the best material to put in that spot or underneath?
I really can't say. You'd have to check with some roofers to find out if there's a source of some of these shingles. And I know that there are architectural salvage people that have materials. Now, since it's got asbestos in it, if it does, that adds to the problem of whether they actually maintain a supply of this or not.
Right. I was just, it doesn't have to look the same. I'm just wondering any kind of material, like a piece of tin or what.
You can probably put a heavy-duty architectural shingle in there that'll have the same thickness, which is, and they're made out of, they're asphalt with either fiberglass or felt base.
Okay. And is there anything else to do to help maintain the roof? Like just the moss should come off.
The moss should come off and right. Keep it clean. If there are branches growing over it close by, have them trim back so the sunlight and air can get to it.
Yep, I did that. And good. What about the dirt buildup underneath?
There shouldn't be a dirt buildup if there's no moss.
There is where there is moss. Do I have to, like, scrape that out?
Well, if you can get there and scrape it out, that's a good idea.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you. Thanks a lot, Gene. John Merrill is our guest as we talk about home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Next is Nick in Green Bay. Hello, Nick.
I just got a dumb question for you. We just moved into a duplex, and we used to have the thermostat that had the mercury switch in there. And we recently replaced with a programmable one, but what are the heat limits that we should have it set at? I've got it set for when we're not there and the dogs are just home at 60, and when we're there, it's at 71. But a friend of mine, he's a network engineer, so I don't know if he even knows what he's talking about. He said that's kind of a dumb way of having it because it takes so long to reheat the house then.
All the research has been done says that you save money by dropping the thermostat setting when you're not there. One of the guests that was on with me from Focus on Energy said that there is a qualifier on that, and that is that if you have too big a gap, then it may not work as well.
Yeah.
And they were suggesting about 8 degrees difference is the maximum you should have.
So 60 to 71 is kind of a big difference.
That's kind of a big difference. So you may want to go 63 to 71 or whatever.
Okay.
The dogs will appreciate it.
Yeah, they get cold. So, but the other thing, real quick, is we've got a humidifier on our furnace, and I turned that on, and it seemed to be dumping water just into the furnace. So I turned it off right away, but now the furnace is was squeaking for a while until it got dried out. How do you fix that humidifier? Do you know or anything? Or?
Well, for one thing, if you have a well-insulated, airtight, fairly airtight house, you shouldn't have a humidifier.
Okay.
Humidifiers cause more problems than not in today's modern houses. In older houses that were really leaky, you needed it because all the moisture leaked out of the house with the heat.
Yeah.
I have had more calls over the years from people who have ice in their windows and mold places, and it's because there's too much moisture. So humidifiers, I wouldn't fix the humidifier unless you're having real problems with getting shocks when you pet your dogs or something like that.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Nick, thank you very much. We appreciate your call. And on to Lawrence in Lawrence, where are you from?
Marathon,
Meriton City.
I have some information that might help the lady that has two furnaces and the other person who has cold cold second floor. I have a 100-year-old house, and the previous owner put the force there in 30 years ago, and I had to put a new furnace in last year. I did a lot of research, and I went around and around with the heating and cooling guy. And the bottom line is, if you have inadequate ductwork for the amount of BTUs coming out of your furnace, the air at the top of the furnace is too warm, and that causes your furnace to cycle on and off. It could be a thermostat, but that's the biggest problem. I had a 125,000 BTU furnace, and I wanted something close to that, and we ended up putting a 60,000 BTU furnace in, and it doesn't recycle like it used to. As far as the ductwork in the older homes, it's usually less than adequate to go upstairs because they have to, you know, fit it through the walls and that sort of thing. But there are inline blowers that you can get to help the situation.
And a good HVAC guy, heating contractor, should know that stuff, right?
Right, but what if you got an older house with a ductwork? It's so hard to put more additional ductwork up there that, you know, you're pretty much limited. But in terms of having two furnaces using the same system, yeah, they should know that. But most, I'm going to say most contractors give people what they want. That's my experience.
Yeah, well, at least you should ask. I mean, what you said is accurate. It's pretty much in line with what I was saying, except you've added some important qualifiers.
Good luck. Thanks. Lawrence. We appreciate your comments, and that's what the program lives on, is people who are able to come along and provide some expertise right down the road. Let's go to Brian in Watertown next. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Good morning. I'm calling about a deck. We have a deck that was probably installed in the house, I want to say, 7 or 8 years ago, and we bought the house 3.5 years ago, and then two years ago in the summer, I'm not sure exactly how long ago that was, but we rented a power sprayer with our neighbor and to clean off the deck and then reseal it. And I guess I got a little excited with the power sprayer and did a little shredding. But we still put the resealant on it, but we're having some of the planks are starting to rot. And I think there are two or three. One of them was partially eaten by our dog, so that probably added to the problem. But so I'm just wondering, what do you think the best way to proceed with that? It's on the northeast side of the house, and so part of it doesn't get much sunlight at all, and some algae growth seems to come back pretty quickly with it.
Well, you need to keep cleaning the deck. It's not, unfortunately, decks are not something you'd sort of do once and then forget for 10 years like the side of the house. You've got to be watching them. And sometimes if the deck is treated properly with a new sealer, the sealer will last 3 to 7 years. Uh-huh. Other times it only lasts a year.
Oh,
it may be that you didn't wait long enough after the power washing to put the sealer on.
Oh.
So it was still kind of wet and uh-huh. The sealer wasn't absorbed.
Okay.
So I would clean the deck, and you can clean it with it. You don't have to use a power washer. You can use a deck cleaner. There are various compounds that are have oxidizing agents that will kill mildew and clean it up and take whatever air the dirt's off, and then make sure it's thoroughly dry.
Uh-huh.
Have some warm days. Wait till the summer when there are some warm, dry days, and
okay.
Then seal it. And seal it with enough, as much sealer as the material would take.
Okay, so just keep putting it on until it stops being absorbed, and
right.
Then
mm-hmm.
I guess wipe it off after
right.
That. And is there anything that the algae seems to come back pretty strong. I guess it doesn't get much sunlight at all, direct sunlight, and so is there any way to prevent that, or do you just keep cleaning it off as it grows?
Well, if you get a sealer that has a fungicide in it, and many of them do, that will reduce make the area less hospitable to algae and other little creatures.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And then keep limbs trimmed to allow more sunlight to come in there.
Keep the air and the sun as much as you can on it.
Right.
Okay. Good luck, Ryan. Thanks very much for your call. Our guest is John Merrill as we talk about home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues today. And let's go to Frieda Marie in Madison next. Frieda Marie, what's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question about how to insulate one wall of my root cellar. All the other stone walls are covered by earth except the one above the entrance door. And it is out of field stone, and I saw this year that it is heavily frosted from the inside. Now, how do I attach there a water barrier or insulation to a stone wall?
You want to do it on the inside?
Well, wouldn't one need to?
Not necessarily, but that
the
maybe...
The outside would look kind of ugly. It's a nice stone. You
good,
know?
Then you want to do it on the inside. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And what type would I use? And is there a foam you just spray on it, or?
Is the wall dry in the summertime?
Well, I could open the door and have a fan go on. We do have ventilation.
No, I'm talking about, I'm talking about water. This is an exposed wall.
Oh, no, it's not, it's exposed to the outside, yeah.
Above grade.
Yeah,
and water
it's
does
above
not,
a door.
And water does not come through it, rainwater.
No.
Okay.
No.
Then you could spray foam on the inside of it. That would
and
be one
what,
way.
What kind of foam is that?
Well, the kind you should have somebody do it for you because it's not available in containers large enough to do this, I think. So you have a contractor that will come in and they'll spray that wall for you.
It's just a small arch over the door.
How big an area is it?
let's say 3 yards by 1.5 yard high, maybe on the highest.
Well,
it's like a half moon.
You can try doing it yourself, buying cans of foam. There's a foam insulation. There's only essentially, I think there's only one kind you can buy in a can. Actually, there are two. There's one that's expanding and the other that's not. But you would want the non-expanding kind. It's very sticky, so it'll stick right to the stone, and you can put that on. And it's a root cellar where you're not living, so that shouldn't be a problem to put it there.
But it should first dry really out, yeah? It always, you know, in a root cellar, it's hard. It's always moist in there, not dripping.
Right,
know,
but if you start with a dry wall in the summertime and put the foam on it, the foam will keep the cold from coming in that area. And,
very much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Frieda Marie. We appreciate hearing from you today. And let's go to Eau Claire and to Janet. And, Janet, what's on your mind?
Hi. I have a question about having a home inspected before I buy it. I'm currently renting with an option to buy a small home built in 1949. And about a month ago, the sewer drain in the basement backed up, and there's a corner in the basement where I'm replacing light bulbs about every 2 weeks. And then with all the snow piling up outside, what would it be worth it? I wanted to close in the next month or two. Would it be worth it to have an inspector come, and what exactly can they get at so I can have some peace of mind where I'm not going to have a big expense should something go wrong?
Well, it's typical these days to have a pre-purchase home inspection. And the person will come in, they've looked at, you know, typically dozens and dozens of houses. They have a checklist of things they check, and they'll look at your heating system, your cooling system, your plumbing, your electrical system, a whole array of things, and give you a report. And you should be there when they're doing it because it'll also give you some education about how to use the house.
Okay.
So, I would. It's a good idea to give you peace of mind.
And do I need to wait till some of the snow is gone before they can get at, say, exterior foundation or the air conditioning unit, or is it just internal mainly?
No, they do inside and outside. Waiting for some of it to be gone, but they can tell something about the outside by what's happening on the inside.
Okay.
I mean, if there's leakage in the basement, they can sort of make an assessment of where that's coming from, even by just seeing the leakage. But waiting till some of the snow's gone might allow them to check some other things. But if you're in a hurry to close, I think you should talk with them about it. But I suspect they will be able to do it for you without having the snow all gone.
And to find a reputable inspector, you call your city people? Or
no, These are private people that work for a fee. Real estate companies typically know about them. You look in the phone book and the yellow pages under home inspector, not housing inspection, home inspector, and look for someone who is a member of one of the professional trade associations. They are now, I believe the term is licensed in Wisconsin, so that there's a screening of them done by the state.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Janet. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. And Lisa in Madison, excuse me, let's give you a chance.
Hi. We have a door. We installed a screen door this weekend, and it's not fitting the doorway. So I'm wondering, do you add wood to strips, or what's the solution, as I cannot return the door?
Oh. So you bought a door, and it ended up being a little bit too small for the space.
Yes. He told me to measure the door, but I was always told to measure the doorway itself. But yeah. I went with the door.
So you went with the door. So, is it so small that there are gaps letting light through, in other words?
Yeah, where it closes, there's half an inch gap there.
Okay.
I'm wondering what's the solution.
I think you should add a strip to the door.
Okay, that's the standard way.
Mm-hmm.
Just go to ask for any.
Well, you need to figure out how much you need. You certainly don't want to have it tight. You want to have a little gap there.
Okay.
You need to measure it exactly. And if it is an unusual, if it's 3/4 of an inch, that's easy because wood comes in that thickness. If it's less than that, then you may need to go to a full service lumber yard where they will make one the right thickness and shape for you.
Okay. Any wood preferred?
What kind of wood is the door?
It's a wood core with metal. It's a Larson door.
Oh, it's a wood core with
It's a metal door?
It's a screen door, but it's a metal door.
With a wood core, yep.
Okay.
A typical Larson screen
door. Wood's still the easiest thing to do, I think. If you go to a full-service lumber yard, they may have another alternative to that.
Okay.
There may be some kind of preformed section that you can put on there that's a half inch.
Okay.
But you need to go someplace where somebody will really be able to pay attention to what you need and work with you on it, as opposed to going to some place where they point you to the section of the store and say, "There's what we have, lady."
Yeah, and I'll also call Larson today. So
yeah, call Larson to see if they have an extension.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Okay,
thank you very much for your call. They very may well, if it's an odd size like that. Megan is next in Ashland. Hi, Megan.
Yeah, I just have a question about the snow on my roof. I have a new roof, and you know, it isn't really steep, so I've got a lot of snow there. And some people, I don't want anyone to get on my roof to shovel it or anything. Is it okay to just leave the snow on there until the weather gets warm?
It's a two-story house?
Well, one story, it's one story and two stories.
Okay. There are snow rakes that you can use from the ground.
Yeah.
That you could use on the one-story portion of it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Having the amount of snow we have on roofs typically is not a problem weight-wise right now.
Uh-huh.
The only problem is the potential for ice dams.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a lot of icicles anyplace?
No, just in one place, like kind of an overhang, and then, you know.
But if you have a lot of icicles and a lot of ice forming there, there's the potential for water to back up, because what's happening with in this snow is the air on the roof is cold, the outside of the snow is cold, but the snow is an insulator.
Uh-huh.
And any heat that's escaping from your attic is warming up the surface of the snow next to it and causing it to melt. So the snow is melting from the inside out, the water's dripping down till it's a cold place, then it refreezes, and then it backs up.
But isn't there an ice, whatever, a 6-foot or thing or what?
Yeah, right. And this is not a problem unless it becomes extreme.
Oh.
A little bit of ice is probably not going to be a problem. We're supposed to have a lot of warm weather for the next week.
Yeah.
My crystal ball says it probably is not a problem for you.
Yeah.
But I wanted to explain the general situation that where the problem could occur,
uh-huh.
which is with a lot of snow and the potential for ice damming. So people need to watch for ice on their eaves. And if there's a lot of ice forming, then it's a good idea to remove the snow.
Okay, and you shouldn't get on the roof, right?
You should not get on the roof. There are people who will get on the roof for you.
I mean, not me, but I'm me.
No. No. There are people who know how to do this, who have the safety equipment to do it, and will do it for you if you need to have it done.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that you need to have it done. I'm just saying that would be the way. A one-story thing, you can do it from the ground. Two-story sections, if that's where the problem is, then you should have somebody who has the proper equipment to do it safely.
Oh, okay.
Are your neighbors doing it, Megan?
No.
Okay,
no.
Well, then it's probably not a need.
I don't think you have to worry about it at this point.
The thing is, you know, the snow doesn't melt on my roof or something. I don't know. But I'll watch it. The weather's supposed to get warm.
That's right. You watch it.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, Megan, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our guest is John Merrill, professor emeritus and housing specialist in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. You can get more information about the work they do there and some recommendations that John has about your house by going to this website, uwex.edu/CES/FLP/house. So that is a good web address for you to get some information. Now let's go to Dan in Rockford. And Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We're debating whether or not to add a bathroom in the basement, and the plumbing isn't roughed in. And I was wondering if you could tell me, is there anything that when I have a plumber come that I should be looking for, or instead of, you know, somebody just wanting to do a quick job, you know, I know about the permits and everything, but is there something where would you recommend being as close to the main line as possible?
Well, you're going to have to tear up the concrete floor in your basement and put a new drain line in, right?
Right.
You understand that. And the more you have to tear up, the more problem there is. You have to figure out if you can get the right slope, which isn't very much, from the commode drain down to that to the main to the sewer main going out.
Uh-huh.
So there are some issues there that you and the plumber have to figure out in order to make it work. Given all things being equal, the less concrete you have to tear up, the better, right?
Yeah. Now, if you were planning on just being in the house for, let's say, 5 years, would you deal with a headache, or would you say it all depends? You know how sometimes the wives have these projects, and it's like, if we're really moving in 5 years, is it worth the headache?
I would be inclined not to do that.
Okay.
For a short period of time, unless you really had a need for some reason or other.
Yeah. No, it was just something that, you know, sure, it had property value, but yet, it's also the headaches involved.
Oh, yeah. It'd be better if you could find a closet or something upstairs that you could add a second half bath to if you need another bath rather than trying to start from scratch in the basement.
Yeah, it would be just a luxury thing. That was just kind of the,
Well, good luck to you, Dan.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And on to Margaret in Janesville next. Margaret, what's on your mind today?
Hi. My furnace sounds like it's gasping for air. And you mentioned blowers and vents, and I don't understand all that. Could you tell me if that has something to do with it, and who would fix a blower if you needed that done?
Well, a furnace technician. If your furnace is making sounds that it hasn't usually made, then you probably need to get somebody to come out and look at it who can do an evaluation. Anybody who has a furnace ought to have it checked every year or two, depending upon the recommendations of the technicians, because there are things that can go wrong that you can't see from the outside, you don't even notice. And now you're actually having something that you notice. So I would clearly, it cost you some money, but it's worth having it done and not have the furnace go out on you at some point and not having it fail in a way that can't be fixed. It could be something going on that could be getting worse and worse and may not be repairable if you let it go too long.
And I noticed one other thing. There's a buzzing sound before it ignites, but it's not buzzing as long as it usually does. It sort of cuts off, but then it still ignites. Does that have anything to do with this?
I don't think so. I mean, that's the electronic starter that's starting up, and it's just maybe it doesn't have to operate as long because the furnace is warmer because it's been cold.
Okay.
I don't know, but that should not be part of the problem. I don't know what the huffing is.
Okay, and could I ask you one more thing? The lady with the snow on the roof, I had a problem with that, and it leaked down. They re-roofed our building. It leaked down into the window frames, and it only did it this one time, and it leaked down the wall. Is that still, do you think, leaking into the wall through the window frames?
Well, that's an ice dam, and that's the water backing up on the roof and coming down the path of least resistance through the house and through the wall and into the window frame. And if you had your roof replaced and you had ice and water shield or some similar product put up a few feet from the edge, that is less likely to happen.
It didn't happen before they roofed it, re-roofed it. It was fine before they re-roofed it.
Oh, it happened after they re-roofed
it? Right.
I don't know why that would happen after they re-roofed it and not before.
Like a hole was in there and maybe it melted together again or something in the summer, but who would fix that kind of work? Who does that?
How long ago was the roof put on?
About a year ago.
Call the roofing contractor back if you haven't already.
What if it was before that? Who would do that if you can't call the roofing contractor? I think they said 3 months, something like that.
Most roofing contractors give you a little more than that. They usually have a year warranty.
Okay.
And if you can't, then you have to get another roofing contractor.
Okay.
And if you can't get a roofing contractor because it's small, then you have to talk with your friends and find somebody they have who does small jobs for them, a handyman kind of person.
And they could get down in the wall and all that?
Many of them are very good. They just like to do small jobs, or they're able to do small jobs, whereas major contractors won't look at something if it's a couple of hours' work because they cost them too much just to get out there.
Okay, so a small contractor.
Right.
All right.
Okay, Margaret, thank you very much for your call. Good luck to you. Joanne in Racine is next. Hi, Joanne.
Oh, hi there. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
And I live in an old house, little bit over 100 years old, I think. And some quite a few years ago, we had baseboard heating put in. We have hot water heat. And I thought that I would like to, economize on the heat and do what they're all telling us to do. So I set the heat back to 60 and then set it at 68 during the daytime. And it takes forever to come back in the morning. I mean, several hours. And so I talked to my heating contractor. I have him check the furnace each fall. And I said, what about this? Well, he said, don't set it back quite so far. So I set it at 62. And then I tried it at 64, too, I believe. And it still takes a long, long time to recover. Is there a reason for that, or shouldn't I be trying to do that with?
Well, I mean, with hot water heat, the heat is nice and even. That's one of its advantages.
Yeah.
And being even means it doesn't change very quickly.
That's right.
So if I were you, I would have the heat go down at 6 o'clock at night.
Because
early.
Yeah.
And then have it come up early.
Oh.
Because you have this lag, and then you have to adjust when you're having it go down, not how much.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Have it drop 4 or 5 degrees as you've been trying to do, but start it earlier because it'll stay warm for quite a while. And it'll,
oh, yeah.
As opposed to having it go down when you go to bed and come up, get up when you get up, back it off a ways.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Joanne, thanks for your call. We hope that that works out for you. Mac is next. Hi, Mac.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Good. I'm calling. I've got an older home. It's 80 years old, and we're going to re-site it this summer. I'm quite certain that there's almost no insulation, if any, in the sidewalls. And my concern is, I've heard that sometimes if with an older home that's not designed for insulation, if you insulate it and make it too tight, you're going to have moisture problems on the interior walls. Is that a concern? And
no.
No, it's not.
Not designed. How old is the house now? You said 100 years?
It's 80 years old.
Yeah. If you put insulation in it and you do a proper job of siding it so you have an air barrier on the inside of the siding on the outside of the sheathing, you shouldn't have a problem. Houses all over the place are being re-insulated.
Now, an air barrier between the outside sheeting and the new
siding.
What type of barrier?
Well, there are a variety of... it depends upon the kind of siding you're putting up. But if you're putting up a vinyl siding, for example, mm-hmm. you put on it's a microfiber kind of a product.
Like a Tyvek or something?
Like a Tyvek. That's one of the brand names
okay.
that you put on it. That allows moisture to get out of the house, diffuse out of the house, but keeps rain from getting in. And it stops air from moving through the siding as well, through the sheathing.
Okay, great. What kind of insulation would you recommend, like blown-in?
Blown-in insulation, either cellulose or fiberglass, either one.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
Great, thanks
Mac,
much.
Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. As we talk with Professor Emeritus John Merrill, who's in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and we're talking about home renovation, repair, and energy-saving issues. By the way, NARI, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, has launched a green remodeling educational program for remodeling contractors. You can get more information at remodeltoday.com, or you can telephone 800-611-NARI. It's remodeltoday.com or 800-611-NARI, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. We're going to pause to catch up with the latest news. We'll come back with John Merrill. He'll take your calls right up until 12:30 today. And a reminder that tomorrow on Garden Talk, Bob Tomisch, senior lecturer in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, will be our guest, and he will be answering your gardening questions, all coming up on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Larry tried to start the show, but lost his voice, and so we sent him home. And we're pleased to welcome John Merrill, Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology and a housing specialist, to the microphones. John, again, a pleasure to have you with us today.
Always good to be here, Jim.
Next time you're here, probably we'll be talking about rain and all those problems of moisture in the basement.
That's right, melt and rain and all that.
But right now we continue talking with our callers, and if you'd like to join us, the number in Madison is 263-1890. And toll-free at 800-642-1234. Dennis starts us off this half hour from Rib Mountain. And, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
A couple things, guys. I had a problem with a two-story house with no heat in the upper story, too. And I talked to my furnace guy about going from 93,000 to 125,000 BTU. And he said, let me get back to you. And so he went and he did whatever he does. And he came back and he said, let's go to two furnaces. And he actually put one in the attic. And, boy, did that change my living. So I don't know if that's a possibility for the people who have been calling in that that have problems with heating on the second floor or not, but it sure changed my life. It made sleeping upstairs a whole lot better than what it was.
Yeah, if you have a large house and extensive ductwork, that's an option for sure. There are many houses that have that. But I think before I would invest in that, I would – look at some of these other options that we've talked about of improving, putting a booster in the ductwork, just evaluating that.
Yeah. One of the houses I had back in the 80s had radiant cable in the ceiling. And it was an insulated cable that ran the full length of the ceiling, and it was put on like, depended upon how many watts you needed for each room, but it was centered on like either an inch and a half, 2.5, or something like that, centers. And then it was plastered right into the ceiling. And it took line voltage, 240 volts, and there was a thermostat in each room. And that was one of the nicest houses that I've ever lived in. And I was wondering, since then, I've not heard anything about that technology. Did that technology die and go away, do you know?
It was radiant heating panels, electrical radiant heating, was really big in the early 90s, I think it was. You could buy little panels to go at the front of your desk, over your workstation. I have not seen much about that. On the other hand, hot water radiant is making a big comeback. There are all kinds of pre-assembled products that you just sort of slap in and connect. And there may be electrical products like that as well. I think the problem is that people are trying to avoid using electricity for heat, even in an efficient way as the radiant would be.
Okay. I wouldn't have thought about that because I'm a transplant from Illinois, and all we've got basically down there is either electric or gas, and both of them are, those prices are sky high. So, you know, it's 10 of one, half a dozen of the other. But with a radiant cable and a thermostat in every room, boy, you could really control how much your electric bill was going to be as opposed to a forced air furnace. So I just haven't heard a lot about that technology since I sold that house, and I've not been in a house since that's had it. So I was just kind of curious. Did it die and go away, or just what happened to it?
Yep.
Died and went away, apparently. Thanks a lot, Dennis. Good luck. Appreciate hearing from you. Tim is next in Kenosha. Tim, what can we do for you?
Hi, Jim. Hi, John.
Hello.
Give my call. I have a mid-60s ranch home, and when you go in the back door, there's a pocket door between the entrance and the kitchen. It runs on the little rollers. Shortly after buying the house, the front roller on the leading edge of the door broke. It's a little like nylon ring with bearings inside that rides on a stationary bushing. And I've searched the internet. I've made phone calls. I cannot for the life of me figure out where to buy this older style hardware. Everything that I've found so far is for like the new closet doors and external mounting on doors and stuff. Nothing that fits on the end of the door and has a piece that goes up inside like the old style. Thought maybe you guys might have some insight.
So you've found the hardware for the new style pocket doors?
Yes.
And that, have you considered converting to that in any way? Is it possible? You'd have to take the wall apart to do that, I guess.
It would be a major construction effort, and I was hoping I could just, because the piece that actually broke with the little nylon part is like two screws off the edge of the door. You know, and it comes right off, and I'm thinking there's got to be some place to buy the old hardware.
Did you try restoration hardware?
As far as a specific place?
Yeah, that is a firm that sells out-of-date hardware.
No, I haven't heard of them.
It's called Restoration Hardware, and you could just Google on that.
So just Google in Restoration Hardware, and then...
Yeah, I think they specialize in stuff that's even older, but they may have... out-of-date pocket door hardware.
Okay, because I've Googled pocket doors, sliding doors, hardware. I mean, everything that I come up with is all the new stuff.
Yeah.
And I've yet to find a site that can get me anything that's between modern and Victorian. There'd just be a big gap in there as far as anything available.
And you've obviously been to lots of hardware stores in big cities where they might have call for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, anytime I've been in Milwaukee, I checked the hardware stores there. Mm-hmm. A couple been in Chicago, I've checked hardware stores there. And
okay.
You get that deer in the headlights look on their faces, and you know they just have no clue.
Well, there's one avenue for you to pursue, and maybe that'll be the answer for you. Chris, let's go to you in Montfort next. Chris, what's on your mind today? You can turn the radio down, Chris.
Yes, I have an old house where the foundation is, I don't know if they call it field rock or whatever, but where they built the foundation, they put all these flat rocks and they mortared it all in. And then on the outside of the house, it looks like maybe at the same time or years later, they sprayed or put on like a thin coat of concrete.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then what I'm wondering is that thin coat of concrete on the outside of this house is starting to flake away and deteriorate, and I can almost see just the edges of this flat rock. And I want to insulate and put a new face on that. And I was wondering if there's anything that I should do that wouldn't harm that or what I should do for that.
You want to insulate on the outside?
Yes, I want to insulate, and then also it's kind of, three-faced, and I'd like to insulate also.
So, is it, insulating the outside. This is above grade or below grade?
Above grade.
And you want to insulate, you want to cover up the stone again.
Yes, I want to cover it up and then also put on another type of decorative base.
That's a challenging operation. What you probably will end up doing is having to put some mortar on it and then set your new face on top of that. But in terms of insulating on the outside, I'm not sure how you would do that.
Well, yeah, so I was wondering, too. I was wondering if, as the existing face now, if I put, like, that foam insulation against that, and then whatever type of face, new rock face I put on the outside, just screw it right tight all the way in. Is that practical?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think you're better off trying to provide the insulation on the inside and renewing the exterior coating if you need to. It sounds like that may have been a waterproofing system for the outside to try to keep moisture from getting into it.
Well, yeah, and it was painted.
Yeah, sort of a damp-proofing kind of thing that was put on the outside. But I would recommend that you try insulating on the inside, not on the outside.
Okay, and not on the outside, but if anything, all I'd have to do is, I think, any of your like Home Depot's, Menards, local lumber yards, I think they sell like these 4x8 sheets or 4x4 sheets of different face. You know what I mean? They'll have
different fake stones?
Yes. Now, is that something that I would use and then just screw right to the existing without putting in the mortar?
I don't know how you're going to fix it to the existing stone.
If I use screws and drills?
I don't think so.
No. Okay.
No. You'd have to have some kind of anchoring system that you put into that stone. So I think you have a major... Doing what you're suggesting is very difficult.
Okay.
I think you're better off trying to take advantage of what you have and make that work for you and do any insulation you want to on the inside of the house.
Okay. And so then outside, what do I do to keep this from all chipping away? I'd have to have call someone up who does mortar work and have them remortar it all?
Yeah, well, you can do it yourself or you can have it done.
Oh, it's something I could mix up and do it myself.
Sure. Right. If you're going to do that, you probably don't want to use a straight mortar. You want to use a latex modified mortar, which has much better bonding.
Okay.
And if you go to a place that really sells this kind of stuff, they'll be able to help you figure out what you need to coat it.
Okay. And then, I understand that. And then one other question. You said insulate the inside of the house, which I had. I was just thinking of a double insulation.
Okay.
So I insulate the inside of the house, but on one side of it, I think I was misunderstood with the moisture barrier putting up the plastic. So it's a heated room in the basement, and what I did is I put up my stud walls, but behind them I put up the plastic, and then I insulated and put up my drywall. But there's probably about a 6-inch gap because the wall wasn't flush straight up and down. Is that going to cause me problems?
Well, the vapor barrier should be on the inside of the studs.
Yeah, it was on the inside. Oh, okay. Yeah, it was on the inside of the studs.
And if there's a barrier between the studs and the stone wall, that's not a problem.
Not a problem, because I got a heat duct that runs right back behind there, too, so I think there is airflow.
Oh, that's not very efficient for your heating to be running in that cold space.
Yeah, that's why I realized this all afterwards. Mainly, we're efficiency for a furnace. Otherwise, besides that, a moisture problem, am I going to have my drywall starting to deteriorate if I put this plastic walls behind the studs but against that rock wall, and then I put the insulation?
Typically, you want the wall cavity to be able to dry out, and you don't have a vapor barrier on the against the wall. You have one on the inside, but that's an area with stone walls that is somewhat arguable.
Okay. So it's just something that time would tell.
That's right. Keep an eye on it.
Chris, good luck to you. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. Josh is next in Spooner. And Josh, what's on your mind today?
I was just calling earlier about a lady called in with the furnace question, saying her furnace sounded like it was gassing for air.
Yeah.
Mine kind of had the same problem. I actually found out that my air intake tube was too close to my exhaust tube, and it was sucking that exhaust back in, causing snow to form in the intake, which clogged the air intake, which caused my furnace not to, to run. So I just wanted to call in.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. that's good. I assume that if that were to happen, the furnace wouldn't run.
Yeah, it would kick on, but it would run for about 5 minutes and then shut off.
Shut off again.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's what another question about my deck. Right now, it's a southern exposure deck. It's just gray, and I'd like to restain that. Question is would a wood cleaner, would that bring the color of the wood back, or would that be something that would have to be done with staining?
A wood cleaner, you should use the wood cleaner to begin with.
Okay.
What is the deck made of? Is it pressure treated or?
Yeah, just pressure treated deck.
Yeah. So you should, before you restain it, or seal it, you should clean it to make sure you're starting with a clean surface that will take the stain or the sealer better.
Okay.
And then that may lighten it up. Many of the cleaners have some kind of bleaching agent in it, which will lighten up the wood somewhat. And then once that's dry and you see the color, then you pick a stain color that will meet your needs after that.
Okay, and then just seal it after that and be done with it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Seal it with a stain, with a sealer that has a stain involved with it. So you're not doing two separate operations. You're putting on a semi-transparent sealer that has a color to it.
Okay, would a Thompson's water seal, would that be something you're talking about?
That kind of a product.
Okay.
All right, Josh, good luck to you. Thanks very much. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. John Merrill is our guest as we continue talking about home renovation. Let's go to Dwayne in River Falls. Dwayne, thanks for waiting.
Hey, thanks. Hi, John. Hi, Jim. Got a question. I'm doing a gas furnace upgrade, and my contractor tells me there's a type of furnace out there that has a dual power mode where in the spring and fall it runs on two burners, in the winter it runs on four burners. Is that a good deal?
I've not heard about that. The latest technology in furnaces is a dual-power blower that's been around for a while. That's now being promoted heavily as a way to do somewhat the same thing. It has a blower that runs really at a higher rate, and then it can go at a slower rate, a lower rate.
I believe the blower runs dual speed in conjunction with this, I remember correctly.
But I have not heard about a system with two levels of burners, and I'm not sure whether that's necessary or not. Or, you know, whether the additional cost, given the fact that modern furnaces don't have as much standby loss as, or not standby loss, loss after they stop cycling, as the older furnaces with pilots. They're very efficient now, so I'm not, you know, I'd have to really look at the payback on having that two-stage burner situation. But the blower business is a good bet, and there's often rebates from Focus on Energy or your utility company on those.
You could check with Focus on Energy, too.
Absolutely, right.
Because if anybody's going to know what's going on in that field,
are
there.
FocusOnEnergy.org.
FocusOnEnergy.com.
.com.
Uh-huh. And if you wanted to call them, it's 800-762-7077.
Would they also be able to tell me about air exchangers?
Yes.
Sure.
Efficiency on those?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Dwayne, thanks very much. Good luck to you. And Michael in Madison is next. Michael, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I tell you, I've got a newer home, well, 12 years old, and I'm looking at lowering my heating and air conditioning costs, and I'm looking at geothermal and solar, and I'm trying to figure out the best way to accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish, and trying to find out how soon you can get the return, the dollar for dollar spent.
Well, definitely go to Focus on Energy. They will do an assessment for you, particularly on solar. There is a fee, but it's not very high, and they will work out the payback for you and tell you what kind of a system you need.
Okay.
They have a special service that does that in their renewable energy section.
Great.
And I would think that the Midwest Renewable Energy Association would also have some information for you.
If I went to the geothermal, I understand it's pretty expensive. And Can you run that geothermal system through an Infor heating system? Do you know?
I mean, the in-floor heating system is circulating. You would not circulate the water from the geothermal. That would, you would have a heat exchanger that would transfer the heat from the from that to the circulation system, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got you now. So you're not talking about the system itself. You're just talking about if you had a forced air heating system.
What, but you can use it with hot water. It's just that the geothermal is the source of heat for the heat exchanger. That would then power, heat the material that you're circulating, whether it be it air or hot water.
Michael, good luck to you. I see we've got research to do there before making a decision. Let's go to Doug in Avoca next. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I had a question about point-of-source water, hot water heaters. Somebody told me that in the vent pipe, if there's a backdraft, that it can blow out the pilot lights on the point-of-source water heaters. And I don't really know a lot about them, but was just curious, and that your pipes could freeze if that blew out. Do you know anything about this?
I have never heard that as a complaint about them. That would, if that were to happen, that would be a major problem.
Yeah.
So I rather doubt that that is typical in a proper installation.
Okay. Are they, or else are they electronic, you know, the electronic ignition, do they have those?
I would think they would. Mm-hmm. Tankless hot water heaters are an ascending kind of hot water heater sold to be energy efficient, so I would expect that they would have modern electronic ignition as opposed to a standing pilot.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, what is your opinion of the, you know, tank versus tankless?
Well, the tankless are pretty expensive, and unless you buy a really big one, you may not have enough hot water to do two or three things at once. The other concern is that they take special kind of wiring because they, or gas piping, because they use a lot of energy when they're working, since they're heating that water, in, you know, from whatever 50 to 110 all in one shot. They're having to use a lot of heat. Another concern is that because the water is going through a coil, the coil is very hot, if you have water that is not really soft, you can begin to get buildup of calcium in the coils, and that can shorten the life. So you want to be sure you have really soft water with it.
Still an issue whether you have a tank or tankless.
So it's not as clear-cut to me, given the fact that they're substantially more expensive and have a few issues. So you need to do a thorough investigation as to your hot water needs and your water source and all that before you decide. On the other hand, if you happen to need additional hot water in some part of your house that's a long way away from your main hot water heater, it might be worth having one as a supplemental hot water heater.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
All right, Doug. Thank you very much for your call. And if we can get to Dave real quick with a question from the Twin Cities. Dave, what is your question?
I have a high-energy furnace with the exhaust and the intake both under a bedroom window. And I'm wondering if I can just put an elbow on the exhaust and extend it about maybe 10 feet so that it's not exhausting right under the right under the window.
I'm not sure you can put one on that's that long because they're engineered for a certain length of pipe to, with the amount of air, amount of pressure that the blower's putting out. You may be able to extend it somewhat, but that length of pipe I think would be a problem. You'd want to talk with your furnace technician before you did that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Dave. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry we can't get to more of the calls or all of the calls. We did mention a couple of addresses that you can get more information from, for instance, focusonenergy.com, and their 800 number is 800-762-7077, and also more information is available at that web address for University Extension, uwex.edu/ces/FLP/house. There's lots of information there that John Merrill has put together along with other members of the staff at the School of Human Ecology. John, thanks very much for being with us today. Been a real pleasure. We look forward to
your
next visit.
Always a pleasure here.
All right. John Merrill. And tomorrow, of course, Garden Talk, Bob Tomish will be in. He's a senior lecturer in the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture and a very fine guest. You will enjoy hearing from him tomorrow on the Ideas Net.